Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll begin. There might be a few latecomers drifting in. The transport has been a nightmare this evening for a lot of people, I know. So, first of all, a warm welcome to everybody to Green Templeton College, to our annual lecture series. This year's theme is Living by Numbers, Big Data and Society. And in the series, we're asking, what's the digital future and how will it significantly change our lives? We're aiming to raise questions about the nature of developments associated with the availability and the analysis of large data sets and the implications for core aspects of everyday life. And I'd like to begin by thanking my colleague Mary Daly for organising the lectures and Sue Drakes and colleagues for the fine administrative arrangements. Dominic for IT, thank you. This is the third of four lectures in the series for 2016. The first lecture focused on research using Twitter and was given by Susan Halford of Southampton University. And then last week we heard from Helen Margetts of the Oxford Internet Institute, who talked about how the internet and social media can sometimes, but not often, bring political change. In this evening's lecture, Professor Tim Lang, the Professor of Food Policy at City University London, will talk about big data, food consumption and food policy, and will explore the significance of the emergence of big data in the world of food. Tim Lang has been Professor at City University's London Centre for Food Policy since 2002. After a PhD in social psychology at Leeds University, he became a hill farmer in the 1970s, which shifted his attention to food policy, where it's been ever since. And for 35 years,
it's true. They're all looking astonished. You can see them. They're all thinking, what's he doing here?
Making it up. For over 35 years, he's been engaged in academic and public research and its debate about the direction locally to globally. And we were just talking about how he's been a thorn in a number of people's sides, really. He's been quite radical, which is fantastic. That's what we want in this lecture series. His expertise is widely sought and valued. And I could give you long lists, but I want to hear him rather than me. So just briefly, he's been a consultant advisor to the World Health Organization, to four House of Commons Select Committee inquiries, to the Royal Institute of International Affairs. He was a commissioner on the UK government's Sustainable Development Commission. He was on the Council of Food Policy Advisors for the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, was appointed to the Mayor of London's Food Board in 2010, etc. He's written many, many articles, reports, chapters and books, many too many for me to list here. In this lecture, now, I should add something, actually, which I think is fascinating, that in addition to having been a hill farmer, Wikipedia tells us that he rides a bicycle to work, doesn't own a car, and grows vegetables and fruit in his London garden. So I'm hoping those are all true.
It's true.
Good? Great.
It's a rarity. Wikipedia is true. Shall we have a vote? Do you believe it?
So in this lecture, he's going to talk about 21st century food challenges. And big food data reminds us that the battle for food control is both about information and minds, not just nutrients, bodies and ecosystems. And he'll talk a bit about the policies that he thinks ought to be developed. So the plan for this evening is that Tim tells me he's going to talk for about 25 hours, I think you said.
Right. Going on 26, is that all right?
Right. But I think I'm going to cut him off at about 40 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
And then we're going to open the floor for questions or comments. And then Professor Robert Walker will propose a vote of thanks. So we're aiming to finish at about 7:20 or thereabouts. It's my great pleasure to welcome Tim, and we look forward to your talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. That's very nice indeed. And Actually, I cursed. I've told her, I've confessed already, Mary Daly, because when she asked me, sort of, back in the 1920s, would I come and do this? So sometime in the middle of last year, I thought, well, that'd be a good idea. Can you hear me all right at the back? And I've cursed her ever since, daily, as they say. Because I found actually very little about big data and food. It's a lot about big data. But what I've done is do quite a lot of digging. And so what I'm going to give you is my overview. And I've actually not done lots of slides. Any of my students knows that I have incredibly dense slides because they're all meant to be read later. This is the reverse. You're going to get very few slides. They're sort of chapter headings. So you can lie back, fall asleep, and think of whatever you want to think of. I'm basically scoping the terrain. And the title, I can't remember, Mary, what you gave me or what we agreed, but I think I've slightly changed it. Yes, she's already complaining from the front. There's a heckle. I'm very happy to be heckled. Within reason. I've sort of changed it because I thought this was a nicer title, actually. And it kind of captures what I'm getting at. But what I'm going to do, you don't need to look, I'll read it. I'm basically going to look at what's meant by big data, where it's emerging in the food sector, and what can we make of it? And my everyday English I've written here, is it a big deal? Is it really hyped up as much as it should be? And I always, because I'm you didn't say in your nice introduction, I was polytechnic trained in the straight from university and PhDs and being a farmer. I went to work in polytechnics and I learnt most of my lecturing skills there. And I learnt put up first what your argument is and your talk. So A, you can fall asleep, and B, you can see if that's really what you do. So I'm not putting it up, but listen carefully and then fall asleep. Essentially, I'm going to argue this. Much policy discussion about big data is focused on the technical power of the new media and internet system, big data generally. It's a managerialist and control ethos that is at odds with the supposed liberatory thinking that's often hooked onto it. The term big data is new, but it's very old in food. The control over data in food is not new. And I see it, and I'm going to argue this, hence the title, Food Democracy. I'm going to say that the issue of big data in food is poised on a cusp that I've argued many times is essentially a tension between food control, top-down control, and democratic control. But it's not as simple as that sort of binary division implies. It's not all. The reality of what's happening in food and big data is not all top-down control, but the democratic impulse is not that yet there. Currently, UK food policy is seeing as big food data as an asset to be stripped. It's development focused, it's developing country focused, and the ethos, particularly in the last 5 years, for political reasons, governments, is that it's best left to markets. There's talk of partnerships, but in fact they're unequal partnerships. I think, concluding, I think big data does deserve more attention in food and food policy. And I think, ironically, it's a cultural argument that matters most. I don't know how many of you have been to, you know, there's a big city called London. Have you been to the Somerset House exhibition, Big Bang Data? Has anyone been to it? One or two nods. It is worth a day trip. It's packed with people looking at it. It's clearly resonating. And I'll refer to it a couple of times. But I think the argument about big data and food does actually have, despite difficulties, has potential to look at what people do, not just what they report. And my friend Mike Rayner in the frontier here at Department of Public Health and Primary Care here at Oxford, Department of Public Health you are now, aren't you, at Oxford, he and I have a long interest in consumer aspirations are not necessarily the same thing as what they do. Big data could be very useful for actually looking at that. And Andy Fern, now at Norwich at UEA, has actually a rarity of having access to big data, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The problem is getting hold of the big data. I think it has potential for gathering information on crops and small farmers in Africa, but so far I see it as being top-down and productionist, essentially, in its approach. It's fraught with many civil liberties problems. Okay, so there's the talk. You can fall asleep. What are we talking about? Well, certain types of knowledge dominate in big data world. In the rich world, a lot of it's about consumer behaviour and choice. I'll talk later a bit more about Dunnhumby. How many of you here have heard of Dunnhumby? One nod, two nods, three hands, four hands, five, maybe 10 out of 70. Okay, it's probably the most sophisticated data system. It's owned by Tesco. It's owned by Tesco. It monitors everything you do except fart, literally. But it knows inputs through to not quite outputs about, and it's predictive. Okay? It's very, very smart indeed. Husband and wife, Dunn and Humby, he, a maths graduate, worked at CACI, C-A-C-I, which was a geographical system of monitoring footfall, set up in 1989, taken on by Tesco to review whether or not it should set up a club card. They were given access to Tesco for 3 months, and at the end of 3 months, when presented to the board, Dunn and Humby, Lord McLaren, then the chair of Tesco, said, in 3 months you've learnt more about Tesco and our customers than I've known in a lifetime. In other words, just the sheer power of the data that they could unleash, they did it. And Tesco then bought 53% of the firm and then 100%. And when Tesco was in financial trouble last year, it looked like it was going to sell it to stave off shareholder concerns, and it was valued at £2 billion. Okay. This is seriously valuable stuff. But when you look at big data in farming, it's mostly applied to low-income countries and small farmers. You can see, you know, the studies by people like Frelat and co, looking at a nice study that came out quite recently, looking at household food security and crop availability. They could draw upon mobile telephone information on 13,000 households. This is still in developing countries, on 93 sites across 17 countries. This is a capacity that social science has never been able to do. And they concluded, some very humdrum conclusions in my view, that improving small farmer market access is better than trying to increase productivity, and that there's no single silver bullet for policy. Well, we could tell them that, but it's the capacity to know the basis for that which has changed. Or we can look at a CGIAR. Everyone knows CGIAR? Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, UN-affiliated net web of sort of techie plant research stations, rice research, potato research, wheat research, and so on, soy. They're running a huge program at the moment. Looked at one study in preparing this lecture on how looking at how climate change is already affecting crop yields in Latin America. They could look across my friend Sergio Schneider on a visiting professorship from Brazil is in the front here with our centre. I haven't had time to tell you about this. 48,000 crop harvests monitored. On soil crops harvest, 11 crops, sugarcane to blackberries to rice, bananas, four partners, approach generated, now being rolled out in five countries. It's scale. The point I'm saying is it's scale. But it's always about things that social sciences have long done, linking demographics, geography, income, location, seasonality, and so on. So there is something bigger. It's scale, okay? Definitely scale, and the technical capacity unleashed
speaks a lot about computing power, but my question is still, is this intrinsically new? Food retailers in the rich Western world, actually often led by Britain, that's why I'm quoting you, Tesco, have long collected detailed information about customer preferences. But psychologists, I'm a psychologist gone wrong, have long plugged the murky depths of consumer motives and looked at the gap between what they think and what they do. Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, any sociologist here I'm sure know about him, was writing about the capacity of social science to manipulate consumer and public opinion in 1928. Nothing new about that sort of imperative. Computer analysts have tried to model human behaviour for a long time. Think game theory, think all sorts of things. So, and competition authorities across the Western world have tried to fathom where power and profit lie in vertically integrated long supply chains for a long time. So is this something new? Let's look at what the academics are saying. There are ESRC project Socializing Big Data, led by Rupert Harvey and Lurie and colleagues, one of my colleagues, Steph Baker, at Citi, very kindly helped me in preparing this talk or gave me her thoughts. A collaboration of five universities was looking at genomics in three areas, big data in three areas, genomics, national statistics, and waste management, waste being the food reason I was looking at it. And their conclusions was that what's new about big in big data is basically novel ways of generating the data. But it's too easy, they concluded, to be in awe of the scale issue. Data can be unreliable, too fluid, platforms are varied, they don't handshake. And their argument from that ESRC project is that big data will only be useful in social science if the workers, the social scientists, collaborate. So in other words, big data doesn't come as a sort of white knight on a charger resolving social sciences problems. It actually merely accentuates the difficulty. You've got to talk to each other. The critique gets sharper from social scientists in the next thing I want to raise. There is a very interesting strand across the general literature that has not been applied in food, which I have called the surveillance critique. Barbara Prainsack at King's College talks of the darker side of big data, drawing on Gary Marx's concerns 15 years ago about soft surveillance and how data flows upwards. She sees, this is Barbara Prainsack, sees soft surveillance in the name of health analytics, Mike Rayner, are you listening, and in pursuit of personalised medicine. And she sees that as a real problem. She talks of three H's in big data as applies to health, which I think are really relevant. Hyper-collection, because the potential to collect data is there, it is collected, but it becomes function creep. We say, wow, 48,000 households, so therefore we'll do it. Maybe 10 studies of 10 households would be better, with more depth and more information. Second H, harm, that it can be information used against the patient's interest. And thirdly, she talks, in her terms, of humiliation. Patient or customer data being given with consent, sign on to release, like I've released that you can tape record me or whatever you're doing to me. But then it's used to depersonalise the customer or the patient. The issue being raised here is how can we define, then set the boundaries between soft and hard surveillance, which is a third line of work that has been done on law and rights. Privacy being a key issue. Go and see the Big Bang Data exhibition. It's really good on this point, actually. But I'll just flag that rather than talk about it. Julie Cohen, in her much-cited book from 3 years ago, nearly 4 years ago now, called Configuring the Network Self, she argues that big data is basically caught between two legal discourses vying for the name of freedom and rights, intellectual ownership on the one hand, free culture, ownership and exchange on the other. And she concludes, echoing the great Karl Polanyi, or I think he's great, and his book The Great Transformation from 1944, no less, really more than that. She says that basically big data is already suffering enclosure. It may be a new technical shift, but it's suffering the enclosure, much like the land suffered the enclosure, which made Oxford University rich, by the way. I used to farm on a farm that was owned by Oxford University until 1950 in Lancashire, really local to Oxford. So the enclosures are actually a very interesting analogy. She talks about the possibility of a new Luddism in response. I think that's very interesting thinking. There's another strand went from academics about big data creating a data divide. Ownership, whose data is it? I think this is clearly visible when you think of Clubcard, Tesco, Dunnhumby, which I've started us off with. This ought to resonate not just with the sociologists, but with the political economists. The flow of big data up, not downwards or outwards. This is data power, or data as power, in the Huxley or Orwell sense. Mark Andrejevic, in his nice book, Infoglut, of 2013, talks about how a sizable chunk of big data is privately owned now and only selectively made available to the scientific community. The owners of the data pick and choose whether they allow Mike Rayner to have it to look at the health outcomes. And that itself is part of what the social scientists of science policy call the framing of the problem. The framing of the data is something we need to be alive in. And there's a very interesting exhibit in the Somerset House exhibition. It's lots of mini exhibits of someone who asks to be tracked by his mobile phone. It is a he, and records actually where he goes all the time for a year. And it's wrong a surprisingly large amount of time. Now, it depends whether we believe him. It's an art exhibition. But it's a critique that has been made very many times, not least by the methodologists who are interested in big data. And here I'm grateful both to my colleagues, Steph Baker and Dan Mercier, who are actually a specialist in... Dan Mercier is a specialist on big data and media use. Their points really are that big data can be useful for correlational analysis, but is inadequate or difficult for causal inferences. The comprehensive big data says little about individuals or groups who are not captured with the data collection. This means that big data are not exhaustive, can obscure or marginalize, for example, consumer categories. That's important for us, Mike. And can even be the source of social exclusion, who's in and who's out. Some of these, they argue, the methodologists, can be rectified statistically. But the point is that we shouldn't be in awe, still that same theme I'm making, in awe that big data is all-encompassing. Much big data, an increasing amount of big data, is commercial data and or collected for purposes other than for research. This raises questions of reliability, particularly, Dan Mercier feels, as the algorithms that generate the data are often programmed to influence the individual or the social contact. So they have a purpose built into their purpose, how they're developed. For example, Sainsbury's vouchers entice the consumer to keep buying a product they might not otherwise want to buy. A point that, it seems to me, falls out of all of this is that big data might potentially cement new academic business partnerships when we've had quite a lot of scepticism, from myself included, about whether these partnerships are on equal footings. This is very, very seductive for academics who are refable and ref-oriented. Could big data, is big data? Yes, it is. Being seen as a new gold field or minefield, but it's certainly the language of business. So, thus far, to take stock, I'm raising familiar questions. This is surveillance society versus efficient management. This is open science versus closed science. This is the old critique, the old Bistris critique of use versus abuse of data. But the importance of the framing assumptions and context being important. And above all, it's raising very important issues about public versus private knowledge, or, to go back to the Romans, who controls the controllers, Juvenal's satirical question, quis custodiet ipsos custodies, who watches the watchman, who guards the guardsman. So we're asking familiar questions. I'm loading up to think about food. Where will this end? Where's it going? How big is the power? But I'm raising also another critical point, which is big data is in danger of reconfiguring what we think of ourselves as. We are atoms in the collectivity. We are owned by someone else. They get the bigger picture about what we are. For policy, and I speak as a professor of food policy, this is very important. At one level, this is exactly what governments have always wanted. They want to be in control. But the language, of course, now is the neoliberal language and the post-Washington consensus of where the market is supposed to be in control and the state should be reduced. So let's have a look at what companies are saying. When I look at, I've trawled and I have pretty good contacts, I assure you, in the food industry, most of the views are optimistic. There is some worry about truth of data. There is a lot of focus upon business opportunities from big data in food. And there is a lot of concern about whose technology will work best. But there is a unanimity that this is another string to the profiteering bow. A lot is made of this. There's a strand of thinking from business analysts, consultancies. Gartner Inc. Talked some years ago of there being three V's in big data: high volume, high velocity, and high variety. McKinsey, I'm a McKinsey man. If in doubt, I always want to know what McKinsey is thinking. I try to teach my students reflex: don't go to a library, find out what McKinsey is thinking. It's quite useful because usually they know what's in the library anyway. For McKinsey, in a really interesting report 5 years ago, they clearly said it has huge potential. And they saw five ways that big data can increase margins for retailers. First, increase information transparency. Second, create and store more transactional data digitally to be more accurate on, I quote, on everything from product inventories to sick days, so monitoring the worker, not just the customer, to improve decision-making, both forecasting and a phrase I'd not heard before, nowcasting. In other words, the speed of knowing what is actually going on when normally you have to wait time before you can find out. Thirdly, allowing ever narrower customer segmentation, and you see that in Dunnhumby, by the way, if you go and look at the few Dunnhumby reports that are made available, you'll see they're segmenting into micro-segments all the time because the data allows them to do that. But they've been doing that since 1994. This is not new. That's how they know what you're going to do when the weather's hot and who you are and what the offers are that come to you with Clubcard. It's why Tesco doubled its market share 15 years ago. Fourthly in McKinsey's list, the value of big data, is that it substantially improves decision-making. It's good for management. It's management control. And then fifthly, it's about developing the next generation of products and services. IBM used to be an infrastructure, a sort of hardware company, now a software, basically added a fifth V. If Gartner Inc. gave you the top three Vs, it was McKinsey that said, no, veracity is our problem. We've got to deal with veracity. But IBM said, well, actually, by using us, you'll get the value out of it. You'll make money out of it. How is this fitting the world of food? Well, actually, it's fitting. You're seeing it in a very generalized way. This is Mary about 4 months into my cursing of Mary Daly for inviting me and me having the idiocy to accept to do this, but I'm happy I did. But let me just give you some observations so far. I think in food, big data reaction is so far quite low-key, and my argument, and it's an argument, and it could be tested, it's sort of thing I would now get a PhD student to go and look at, is it because they already got such a high degree of control and high degree of sensitivity to customer and customer variation that this is only a twist further for them? It's not a quantum leap. It's an acceleration, not a quantum leap. It doesn't shake existing intra-sector, intra-food supply chain power relations. Sergio, that's the point I think is interesting, because it's retailers who control the food system. They're the gatekeepers. They're the intermediary. And big data that they've been generating and using, sorry, we have been generating and they own, is what's enabled them to do that. The second theme that I think is emerging is a very old one in food policy. He was here towards the end of his working life. Beveridge, who's one of my heroes, you know of him, possibly as the so-called father of the welfare state. He wasn't. He was the architect of the Ministry of Food in World War I, and he wrote, I think, one of the greatest books in food policy in 1928 called British Food Control. The term was apt. He said, we're up against it. We need to control the food system. It's out of control. The theme running through food big data and food and big data is power. This is absolutely in keeping with the central theme in food policy. The fear of combines, trust, literally what used to be called trust, or in American antitrust laws, the fear of combines, of the power of big food, as the Americans now call it, the big retailers, the big manufacturers. The new food service, the emergence of catering companies. Two companies now dominate the catering market. Three companies dominate the takeaway market in the world. So is the question, research question emerging there, I think, is big food data actually new? The third of interest to Colin and Ruth Tudge at the front here is that actually most of the money and most of the thinking is going, when it's about food, Colin and Ruth, is actually that it's about farm value adding in developing countries. That's where most of it is. Nothing about Britain and agroecology and small-scale farming in Europe. It's all about how can we maximise yields and increase outputs of small farmers in Africa. This is heavily yoked up to the notion, a beloved notion at the moment, of precision agriculture, that crunching data from diverse sources, using sensors to analyse soil content, coupled with social media posts from farmers spread all over sub-Saharan Africa, can link with local market price information, and GPS signals will give farmers real-time information. That's the sort of phrase here. IBM, I'm going to cite IBM, they are making a big song and a dance about their weather modelling technology, really smart stuff, about climate change, deep thunder, showing how they are enabling farmers in Borneo to make smarter decisions, plant more rice and reduce imports. It's kind of that stuff, linking water droplet application or water availability in rice growing fields with plantation times and so on. The fourth theme that I think comes out is that high tech focus predominates as though it is value neutral, which is, I think, an erroneous assumption. There is no technology that is value neutral. Let me quote here the point at which I got very excited for the first time. I stopped blaming Mary Daly for inviting me and my stupidity for accepting this, was when I read the speech of the Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, Liz Truss, who basically has talked about the British Government commitment to basically give away British food data. Just give it away. At one level, this is on June the 25th, last year. The mass release of government data is in line with the reduction of state, but once the apparatus has gone, what is the point of repeating it? And essentially this is about partly the privatization of the state and the reduction of the state. So there is a very interesting, it's the first policy commitment about big data and food that I can find. Interesting. Nesta, an interesting body, very interesting body. Last year they came to me, maybe they came to you, Mike, 2 years ago, 2014, set up a Nesta Open Food Data Challenge. Nesta, the National Endowment Fund for Science and Technology. Do you know it? Some of you nodding, some not. Go and have a look at it. They basically called for ideas about open food data. Come up with things. But when you looked at actually the big process that went on, the winner was a small business combining government and company and health data to create an open package for food service industry on allergens. I thought this was a bit of a damp squib, to be honest, but they got the 40 grand. Is that a big deal I've written here? I mean, it's interesting, but the law had already said caterers have to declare what potential for allergies are in their ingredients, and they were getting advice from all sorts of people to do it. Fifth theme. I think the most interesting thing, other than Liz Truss's freeing of our data, is that the European Union is getting interested. And this is going to be a tortoise and hare. It's if Liz Truss has come out and said, OK, it's yours, I'm giving it away, we don't want the state doing this, it's our data. The European Union is being slower and more methodical. The key point here is that legal ruling 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, you may have noticed it, the right to be forgotten data. I don't know if other speakers have spoken about that. They have. This goes back to the 1995 Data Protection Directive and a case that went all the way through to the Court of European Justice, European Court of Justice. And it was a ruling that it is your right to have your data deleted. It's a right to be forgotten. But the EU as a whole is at the moment, or the Commission, is in facilitating mode that's familiar to any of us who work in that world. It's set up a project called Big Data Europe. It's high-tech focus, of course, but it's been holding expert data workshops on food and agriculture only from the middle of last year. So this is very recent. This is unfolding. When I started getting into this, I could see why I couldn't find anything in the sort of formal literature. It's because it's not there yet. It's not been written up. But in the EU too, the focus is on high tech and farms. And we're seeing, even though it's the EU, the CGIAR Big Data Analytics Platform joining in, a partnership of countries, the Greeks to German universities, FAO, CGIAR, the pharmaceutical industry and so on, but no British. Interesting. Sixth theme. There is this constant theme in the writing and in the projects, maybe it's the rhetoric at the moment, could big data in food actually help us get at hard-to-reach populations? And without a doubt, all the people I interviewed and spoke and contacted said, the only ones who said anything of where they thought something interesting was going on or knew about it, pointed me to the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition Programme, GODAN, G-O-D-A-N, launched in 2013. This is a global consortium of the US government, DFID here, Government of Netherlands, FAO, the Technical Centre for Agriculture and Rural Cooperation, GFAR, Open Data Institute, I'm going to come back to that at the moment, CGIAR and CABI. It's now got 200 partners worldwide. This is a seriously big network all about big data and food. And its goal is very simple. I quote, to harness the growing volume of data generated by new technologies to solve long-standing problems and benefit farmers and the health of consumers. But I can't find anything about health, Mike. It's all about small farmers so far. But maybe that will change. But it's not yet there. It's already interested in gathering the data on the health status of the poor in developing countries. And if ever one needed to have a sort of flag waved, let me just tell you, this month, last week, the Gates Foundation, so this is Mr. Big, everyone bows before the new country called Gates World, the Gates Foundation has called for the standardisation of agricultural investment data. I quote, to increase the amount of timely and standardised data on agricultural investments, not on what agriculture does, but on agricultural investments, in order to make those investments more effective, to update industry standards to be more relevant and useful for agricultural investment decision making. This brings me now to where I start getting more positive. The Open Data Institute. Anyone heard of it? Yes, a few nods, not many, one or two. Well, this is sort of cuddly bear time. This is our own Sir Tim Berners-Lee and Sir Nigel Shadbolt. We're on home territory, lots of sirs. The goal here is to bring open data's benefits to specify areas of society and industry across the data spectrum. There is the data spectrum. I think this is one of the only interesting things I've found in trawling hundreds of documents. Essentially, I think they get it, that most data, well, data has a potential to be closed or to be open or shared, and there is sort of pressures going in all way, and they're beginning to classify it. There's beginnings to be something quite interesting in its thinking. This is £10 million of yours and my money, funded by government, the UK government through BIS and the Technology Strategy Board, plus one foundation that I confess I'd never heard of, the Omidyar Network, which has given them $750,000 US dollars. It's basically a very large philanthropy network. This is taking a broader take on big data potential, and its focus is only on five things: agriculture and nutrition top, data infrastructure, finance, global development and open cities. So I think we're going to see something there. This is, if you look at their workshops and go onto their website, you'll find it quite interesting. Okay, we're beginning to get there. I think I'm sort of on time. I've got 5 minutes more, I think. The future. I'm going to offer six research questions. The first, did I put these in? I did. The first is, does big money going into it herald a bubble or a new genome? I think the research that I've seen, the consortium done, the LSE and Manchester gang, I thought it was too apologetic. There needs to be sort of looking, let's look 20 years ahead. Will this bubble burst? Will it be a genome or will it be a new tulip bust? The key issue, I think, is who owns the big food data? Currently, it's owned by logistics companies. In Tesco's case, it owns Dunnhumby, so there's a merger of the two sectors. But Sainsbury's diverges it. What's going on there? Is the future one in which sectors of the food trade vie for whose data on and control over the consumer matters most? Can we imagine, Colin Tudge, can we imagine big funds going into big data for agroecology? Can we imagine that? I think that's a very interesting question. The more I've thought about that, the more I think that's interesting. What would it look like for big data to help agroecology and small farm sustainability? It could be there, but we're not seeing it there yet. One taker for this, actually, is the very interesting philanthropic consortium, not as big as Gates, but is the Global Alliance for the Future of Sustainable Food. This is the sort of thing, when preparing this, Mary, I thought, actually, I'm going to write to them and say, why don't you set up a research strand to start doing this, to go a bit beyond what the top-down people are doing? Research question two: is big data essentially a trope? Is Are we being seduced by Manuel Castells? You note I haven't referred to him so far, but now I will, whom I've met and had dinner with and is very charming, as you maybe know. But is an old sort of Marxist, Gramscian, you know, well, if you know Castells, you know Castells. This is the belief that we inhabit now, network world, it's all bottom up, everything's different, democratization is now intrinsic, it's lateral networks, not top down anymore. It's a democratizing food world, if we transfer that. Or if you watch the telly, this is Paul Mason's world. This is optimistic, but downplaying how it doesn't quite work out in practice. So the question, I think, is to ask, if you have a PhD student, is big data in food a hype of linear evolution and progress? Is it an argument that is being overstated, that implies that somehow we've moved from the service, food service economy, to the food information economy? That is researchable. But the issue is still deserving of some scepticism. Research question three, I do see this as a new interesting development in the long battle that I've written about myself and many of us have over the consumer. E.P. Thompson, in his, I still think, fabulous essay, The Moral Economy of the English Crowd in the 18th century, argued and showed, and then was much argued and debated about, that the shift from medieval, pre-industrial sets of assumptions about where your food comes from to the industrial society, where you were individualized and individually responsible rather than socially supported by monasteries mostly when things went wrong. Is this a new shift? Is this, as some of the writers have said, that this is the 21st century, or hinting at, that this is the 21st century food self where we are predictable, or as one writer has called it, the quantified self, that this is the quantified eater, the eater who thinks they are in control, who thinks they have choice ad nauseam, but in fact are known about and predictable before they've even done it. That, I think, is a very interesting question. And the fourth, because I promised myself 3 years ago when reviewing my life in food policy and food research, I think we have failed to actually carry on some of that early rural sociology and industrial sociology interest in the food worker, food as work. I think this is a really interesting research topic, to actually say, what is food work that is big data food work? Who is doing it? And my argument is, anyone who knows my book with my dear friend Yanni Gabriel, the new, and we promise ourselves the last edition of our book, The Unmanageable Consumer, is on this. It's about the worker, the consumer now being the worker, this notion that Alvin Toffler suggested 36 years ago, that the prosumer is the modern figure. You and I think of ourselves and are encouraged to be thinking of ourselves as consumers, but we are actually workers. We're working for free on the internet, providing information by having a mobile phone and so on. We need to unpick that labour process in big data. Research question five, I put it even strongly, is the power overstated? Is it not just a bubble, but overstated? What is the power? We ought to unpick it rather than just having a look, like mine, over a few months preparing for this in dribs and drabs. I think, I'm beginning to end, I'm reminded by Dunhumby. When I first became aware of Dunhumby in 1994, I had a wow moment, okay? And I've watched it develop ever since. And I've watched the husband and wife sell it. They literally cashed in for about 70 million at one point. Research question six. I think there's some work to do, in other words, within the power relations of I could see product supply chains where we would want to know where is the big data element of this. We did a study at our centre, an EU6 framework study, of the wheat supply chain. And it was so complex. Here's something simple like bread that actually manufacturers make it in industrial bread didn't actually know where their ingredients had come from or what was in them. For something very simple like bread, this is not artisanal bread. Now, the role of big data in that, my hunches would make it more complex rather than more simple. But the sixth and final research question is, what will the state do? What's the role of the state? Is it like Liz Truss, our Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Refuge, giving it away, facilitating the asset stripping? Is that what the role of the state is? We see at the European level the state operating as the defender of the right to be forgotten. So there is a tension within the state there that I think is very interesting. So my refrain in this lecture is that we have, on the one hand, a fear that big food data might be big food brother, the resistance of our Prime Minister, graduate of this university, as I'm sure you know, to intervening on childhood obesity, and so on. So my conclusions, to summarise. Oh, I've put thanks up, not yet. My conclusion, 1 minute. I do think this is rich territory for social science on food. It's got political dynamics. It's actually got me interested. I blame Mary Daly for this now. It connects with ordinary people through to the power elite. It's a policy lens through which we can assess food systems. Secondly, I do think it's a test case for consumer sovereignty. I think we're at the moment in awe of big data and we're not saying, what's it doing for me? I don't see much value coming to consumers so far on food. Maybe you'll prove me wrong. Thirdly, I do think this is a new phase in the long democratic struggle. If the reality is big data plus big food, where they want our facts and money, this is a new strand in control over food and us. Mike Rayner, my friend at the front here, and I spent 20 years working with the consumer movement of Europe to try to get better nutrition labelling, trying to get quantitative ingredients declaration labelling, and we haven't got that sort of information flow over big data. Is this something that it now has to be done? And I remind you, as a still a very angry 68-year-old professor of food policy, we had food expressly kept out of environmental information. You know about the energy impact of your washing machine and your car by law, but not your food. And it was kept out. I was the advisor to Stanley Clinton Davis, Lord Clinton Davis, when he was commissioner for the environment, and he was incensed, and so therefore I was incensed. And he's long dead, but I think he was absolutely right. Why, given the power of big food and big data, why is that data not just handed over to us in ways that are acceptable? But on a more optimistic and positive note, I do think I found myself wanting to throw it out and said, no, you can't. This has potential. Big food data does have possibilities too. I think it would be and could be something where we could calculate the realities of unsustainable diets. But that would depend, as ever, on whether we, the critics, and I mean that in the nice use of the word critics, are noisy enough. And it depends whether we get our political representatives in parliaments to start taking this seriously. And it's not used to target welfare or lower wages or other possibilities. On that note, I'll stop.